You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Santa Fe New Mexican is hiring. Immediate spots are open in the company's production department, and eagle-eyed listeners with a keen sense of style, wit, and diligence can learn more about copy editing positions at Pasatiempo. Visit sfnm.co/tnm_careers for more information. We'll also include the link on today's podcast at radiocafe.org. The Santa Fe New Mexican is an equal opportunity employer. I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Dar Jamail. He's an award-winning journalist and author of three books on Iraq, including Beyond the Green Zone, The Will to Resist, and The Mass Destruction of Iraq. His new book is The End of ICE, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. He will be speaking at the Lensic on Wednesday, March 13th, as part of the Lannan Foundation series. Welcome, Dar. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be with you again.
So I have been reading your book over the last few days, and I actually found that I had to take breaks because it was so intense and really heartbreaking to travel with you to all these different places in the world where climate change is dramatically evident. Let's start where you start your book, in Alaska. You fell in love with Alaska and its landscapes and its mountains as a young person. And over the last few decades, you've seen massive changes there, from glaciers melting to losses of indigenous cultural practices and lots more, all caused by climate disruption. Tell us what it means to human societies and to ecosystems to be losing so much ice.
Yes, it's the obvious implications are, for humans, the lack of drinking water and irrigation water for farming. And so we have, for example, over in the Himalaya, there's a massive ice sheet there fed by glaciers, and it's rapidly diminishing. And the seven rivers that come out of that are drinking and irrigation water for 1.5 billion people. So if that ice is completely gone by 2100, which recent studies show that it could be almost in its entirety gone by 2100, so that's obviously a dramatic and catastrophic impact. But lesser impacts, but just as important in other ways to nature, are that I wasn't aware of this, and I think many other people aren't either, who aren't deeply involved in the science already, is the role that glaciers play on the ecosystems where they're located. So, for example, if you have a glacier in a valley, it's going to be keeping the temperature of that valley within a certain range. The streams coming out of that glacier are going to be cooler and for further downstream. So certain fish and insects are going to live in those areas. And then the birds and other animals that rely on those are going to be there. That glacier is going to provide enough groundwater for trees to be at certain elevations and to exist year-round, and other types of vegetation. If you remove that glacier, all of that changes and goes away. Including all the wildlife supported there, as well as the trees and the vegetation. So they play a critical, critical role, not just for humans, but for entire ecosystems. And so as they're being lost, large swaths of nature are going with them.
And extinction at a rate that has never happened before.
Well, we right now are in the sixth mass extinction. We are losing between 150 and 200 different species every single day. It's 1,000 times higher than the normal background extinction rate. We're on track right now with what's happening to the climate, to other feedback loops that are already set in motion, that we're rivaling the Permian mass extinction as far as how fast this is happening. And that extinction event, which occurred 252 million years ago, took out 90% of all life on Earth. So we are in an extremely dangerous and precarious time, given the extinctions that are already upon us, and particularly looking at the fact that all of this is accelerating.
Another catastrophe in the making from melting ice is the methane that's bubbling up from the permafrost. And the permafrost is basically areas that have never melted during all of human history. What's going on there?
Right, hence the name, which is going to have to change. So permafrost, which is across all of the Arctic, it holds a massive amount of organic material. It's basically frozen ground underneath a layer of tundra, and it's thawing rapidly. And one of the scientists I spoke with, who's an expert on this of several decades and has been studying it around the world, warns that as it thaws and as it reaches freezing point and 1 degree above that, it is then releasing organic material, and that's off-gassing CO2 and then a lesser amount of methane into the atmosphere. Enough so that under normal conditions, permafrost is actually pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. Now it's actually on track to become a net carbon source. More dangerously even than that is the subsea permafrost in the shallow seas across the Arctic, as the sea ice is retreating and thinning, allowing that ocean to absorb more solar radiation and warm up faster. The subsea permafrost, which contains methane hydrates, that is starting to thaw. And we already know for a fact that there's large areas that are seeing a pretty significant amount of increase in methane plumes, and that methane is then being released through the water into the atmosphere. And methane is a extremely potent greenhouse gas. It's 85 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 on an 85-year time scale. And we're actually under threat of a potentially cataclysmic release of that. One of the scientists whose papers I cite in my book, Dr. Natalia Shkova, has warned that we could see literally a 50 gigaton burst of methane released at any given moment. And that would be the rough carbon equivalent of half again of all the CO2 we've emitted into the atmosphere thus far. So we are under threat of a potential half a degree C to 1 degree C, almost immediate increase in Earth's temperature if something like that were to occur.
And so just to be clear, we're talking about in a very short period of time, we could release as much carbon as we've done since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution?
That's right. And a corresponding immediate increase in the amount of, that we've warmed the atmosphere. Right now, we've warmed it about 1.1 C since the Industrial Revolution began. And literally, we could see a doubling of that almost instantaneously on a human time scale instead of a geologic time scale.
One of the things that I think is hard for people to understand is how the increase in temperature of a degree makes such a huge difference. Can you help us get that?
Well, it's 1 degree C temperature increase. It doesn't sound like much. If we look out and we check the weather, whether it's 50 degrees F outside or 52 or 53, we don't even think twice about that. But nature evolves slowly most of the time and adapts and situates itself around certain degree parameters. So, this is why certain species exist in certain places on the planet within certain temperature ranges. And nature has balanced itself absolutely perfect over geologic time to the situation on this planet. And if we do things, which literally we have geoengineered inadvertently by the fossil fuel economy of the planet, we have literally geoengineered the atmosphere to fill it with CO2 to warm it up, and we've warmed up the oceans and changed the chemistry of them as well. So we already have engaged in geoengineering and are living with the results. So for example, one thing I cite as an example of this in the book, I have a chapter on trees where pine bark beetles, for example, they overwinter at elevation, and in extremely cold temperatures, 99% of them are killed off through the winter, and that kind of keeps them in check. As we warm up the temperature even just 1 degree, maybe instead of 99% of them being killed off, 98% of them are killed off. That's basically a doubling of the amount of beetles that now start out through the summer, and then we see across the American West, and I know in New Mexico this is very visible, the decimation of trees from this, and especially in places like California, Montana, Wyoming, et cetera, where massive tree kills are happening. And that's just from 1 degree, one little tweak in the system, and we see these massive impacts. And of course, that leads to them being vulnerable to drought as well as a dramatic increase in wildfires, which is exactly what we're seeing.
In one place in the book, you said that if the amount of warming that we've produced that has been absorbed by the oceans had instead been put into the atmosphere, we'd have seen a huge rise in temperature.
The oceans have absorbed 93% of all the heat that we've put into the atmosphere. To give people an idea of how much heat that is, if the oceans had not absorbed it, our atmosphere today would be 97 degrees Fahrenheit hotter right now. So it's an enormous amount of heat. This is why the last 5 years, each year, each succeeding year, has been a record warm temperature year for the oceans. In fact, a report came out in The Guardian warning that there are heat waves ravaging parts of the oceans, and they liken them to wildfires burning across the oceans because that's the effect they're having on many of the species and organisms that live in the oceans. And given that the oceans are where we came from, they play such a critical role on the planet as far as generating oxygen and as a food source and so many other things. The fact that we are causing such dramatic changes to them is extremely alarming.
And as one of the scientists in your book said, it's easy to be apathetic about the oceans. I mean, we might walk into a forest and see the result of beetle kills or wildfires or whatever, but we don't have that kind of access to the ocean. And the amount of destruction that's going on there, I mean, one of the things that you write about is coral reefs. And probably many listeners know that coral reefs are in trouble from warming and acidifying oceans. But talk about the significance of coral reefs within the larger ocean ecosystem.
Right. Coral reefs occupy a very, very minuscule percentage of the seabed, but as much as a quarter of all marine species spends part or most of their lives on or nearby coral reefs. And so that fact alone should be worrisome, given how much of the world depends on fish sources, reef fish specifically, as a large percentage of their nutrition. So it's troublesome because the biodiversity in the coral reefs is so great that many scientists believe they're actually as biodiverse as the Amazon rainforest. So what of our future pharmaceuticals might come from these reefs that we're essentially taking out because of warming oceans from climate disruption, not even to speak of the nutrition source. And then there's, of course, the cultural and spiritual and indigenous cultures around the planet that live right nearby coral reefs and rely on them for that. So there are numerous factors as to why they're so critically important in the marine ecosystem. And as we're watching them go, the Great Barrier Reef is the great example. It's had several major coral bleaching events in a row now. It's poised right now to be starting yet another one on top of the Australian government preparing to dump massive amounts of toxic sludge onto the reef, essentially smothering the coral. And this is the single largest coral reef on the planet. And we're literally in danger, as many Australian-based scientists have warned. They believe it's in its terminal stages and probably won't last another 10 years. And this is a 1,400-mile-long coral reef. That comes on the heels of a stunning National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report from 2011 that warned, even back then, and things have accelerated dramatically since then, but even from 2011, they warned at current trajectories without dramatic change and mitigation, we're under threat to lose almost all coral reefs on the planet by 2050.
And that has a huge effect on the food chain because, I mean, there are so many, as you say, it's very biodiverse, but it's part of a much, much larger web of life in the ocean that isn't necessarily adjacent to the coral reefs.
That's right. You know, if we lose the coral reefs, it's going to have a cascade effect, just like every other impact and injury that I get into in the book, whether, you know, you talk about the loss of trees or the loss of glaciers, there is going to be a cascade effect. And I think one of the most worrisome parts about these cascading effects is the unforeseen consequences. You know, one of the reasons many of us who write about climate change and particularly scientists studying it are so worried and concerned and opposed to geoengineering, which is getting talked about more and more as a solution to buy some time from climate change to try to change things, is the unforeseen consequences. You know, humans are behaving as though we're God and that we can just tweak these natural systems on the planet and have it figured out. And we've done the research. And the reality is nature is so complex that, you know, for example, I spent a lot of time working on the book in the Amazon with Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, often referred to as the godfather of biodiversity. And he warned that literally, you know, this is a guy who's been studying the Amazon for more than 50 years. And when I ask him about it, he says, yeah, we're just scratching the surface. We have so little idea of what actually happens. And we think we know so much. But in reality, the more we learn, the more we understand how little we actually know and how much we have to learn. So if we step into that complex system and start tweaking the dials, raising temperatures, diminishing rainfall, shifting rainfall patterns, and all these other things that climate change is causing around the planet, we still are just barely beginning to see the consequences of these actions.
Your book makes so clear exactly what you're talking about now, namely the importance of systems thinking, complex systems thinking. And the reality is that no region is really isolated anymore. You can't protect an ecosystem locally by declaring it a preserve or whatever, because it's connected to so many other systems. And it seems that governments have not figured that out or mustered the will or vision to respond in a systemic way, even as the consequences are more and more obvious, namely threats to the food and water supply, national security, refugees, and stuff like that.
That's exactly right. And in fact, one of the studies I mentioned in the book is one that came out within the last year talking about telekinetic connections between forests. For example, if we have massive wildfires in the western United States, that literally does have a direct physical impact on boreal forests over in Russia, for example, that everything is so deeply interconnected that that's the part that Dr. Thomas Lovejoy emphasized over and over again, as did so many of the other scientists that I spent time with working on the book, is that, you know, the more we learn, the more we understand how much more we actually have to learn. And this is why towards the conclusion of the book, I start being led into this place, which is my thinking today, which really indigenous perspective is the only thing that makes sense at this point, the deep interconnection between everything. We can go on treating the earth as other, as though we're disconnected from it. Well, it's obviously completely unsustainable, and that's clear now to anybody paying attention, because the reality is the opposite. We are absolutely connected to everything deeply, and that's why we have to walk very, very gently upon earth and treat it as sacred and as precious as it is, because our very lives depend on that. And again, this is something I think that is abundantly clear to anyone really paying attention to how rapidly climate change is progressing at this point.
Talk for a moment a little more about forests. You write in the book about the many threats to forests. Forests have traditionally been a carbon sink. They've absorbed carbon through photosynthesis, but that's no longer necessarily the case. Explain what's going on and how that combination of climate and degradation and fragmentation of forests are affecting not only the forests, but all of us.
That's right. And in fact, one of the experts I spent a lot of time with in the forest chapter of my book is Craig Allen from right there in Santa Fe, who's been studying trees and ecosystems in Bandelier National Monument for decades. And he, along with numerous others that I went and spent time with in the field, from down in Sequoia National Park to, again, in the Amazon with Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, and you know, to really underscore the importance of trees, because they're so easy to overlook. I mean, they're kind of the iconic go, you know, hug a tree, plant a tree of the beginnings of Earth Day and conservation movement in this country. But it's easy to overlook the critical role they play in sequestering carbon, in protecting the soil and the wildlife and areas where they grow, providing shade, providing housing, holding water in the ground. They play such critical roles in all of this. And using the Amazon as an example, you know, this is extremely biodiverse, rich part of the planet that plays a critical role in climate change, and that it, on a grand scale, does what so many forests do, which is it sequesters carbon from the atmosphere. Those trees are literally pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. And as the temperatures warm up, as trees dry out, as they burn, as they're clear cut, all these injuries happen. The Amazon, for example, NASA has already released reports that show it's actually had weeks, even at certain periods, months, where instead of sequestering carbon, it's become a net carbon source. So when we have that happening in a place as precious and critical as the Amazon, that does not bode well for the future. And as temperatures increase, you know, again, it comes back to that 1 degree scenario we discussed earlier. If you turn the temperature up just 1 degree, that might be the difference in a forest, depending on where it's located, latitude, altitude, et cetera, as far as is it absorbing CO2, is it sequestering it, or is it warming up and drying out to the point where it's now releasing it? And that's what we're starting to see more commonly across the planet.
Another place you visited is Florida, a significant chunk of which may be underwater by the end of the century or sooner. And you talked to this extraordinary man called Philip Stoddard, who's both a professor of biology and the mayor of South Miami. And he's talking about what it's like to be the mayor of a city that might soon not exist. One of the things that he and others are trying to deal with, I mean, talk about him, but also one of the things that really struck me that I hadn't really known about was the fact that when areas vulnerable to flooding go underwater and they're covered with toxic materials, industrial materials, nuclear materials, whatever it is, that creates another kind of disaster scenario.
That's right. So Dr. Philip Stoddard, he is actually the perfect politician in that he did not ever want to be one. Some friends held a house party and invited him. He thought it was just a get-together party, and they all agreed and nominated, said, hey, we're going to nominate you. You have to run for mayor. And now when I spoke with him, I believe he was in his fourth term, if I remember correctly. And it's because he's telling the truth about climate change and sea level rise, and he's extremely intelligent, and he's doing everything he can to try to safeguard his city. And he, along with some of the other scientists I spoke with down in that region, spoke very frankly about what needed to happen. And one of them is that, yes, we need to start literally relocating people. The government, it's their job, it's their duty to step in and start doing this, fund it, manage it, oversee it, etc., as well as closing down nuclear plants like in South Florida, just south of Miami, is the Turkey Point nuclear plant sitting at 6 feet elevation right on the coast. And instead of these things happening, shut down the nuclear plant, mitigate the toxic waste zone so that once it all does go underwater, not if but when, probably sooner rather than later, that won't be leaching up into the ocean for future generations to enjoy. And instead of that, the Turkey Point nuclear plant is adding a third reactor. There's none of this mitigation or relocation happening. And so Dr. Stoddard warned, just like other scientists down there I spoke with about sea level rise, that we're going to have chaos if we keep kicking the can down the road instead of having an orderly relocation of millions of people from South Florida now that's government controlled and done in a sane way. Once that real estate bubble fully pops and deflates, we're going to see utter chaos. And unfortunately, given the policies of the country and this lunatic administration, that's what we're on track to see in certainly all the coastal cities.
The projections about the amount of sea level rise we're going to look at and when vary, and it's unpredictable to a large extent, but the reality of the rising is very real. It's already happening. What are the factors that contribute to sea level rise?
Well, the primary one is the loss of ice from Greenland and the Antarctic. So those are the two leading sources. We've already seen a significant contribution from land-based glaciers, although the brunt of that pulse has already passed since there's been so much loss of that ice already. So now the two things to really keep an eye on are Greenland and the Antarctic. The Antarctic, of course, a study came out just a couple of months ago, a six-fold increase in melting there since just 1970. The lead author of the study, Dr. Eric Rigno from UC Irvine, warned that he told the New York Times right in the wake of that study being made public, he said literally, quote, "The Antarctic is melting away." So we are looking at untold amounts of sea level rise coming. I can give people a hint, and I mentioned this in the book. Dr. Harold Wanless of University of Miami, a leading sea level rise expert internationally, and he said, look, I'll tell you what's happening. When we came out of the last ice age, as the planet thawed out and warmed up, a lot of CO2 was released, and there was a 100 part per million CO2 increase in the atmosphere. Corresponding with that was 100 feet of sea level rise. So I thought about it and did some quick calculations in my head. When the Industrial Revolution began, CO2 content in the atmosphere was 280 ppm, and now we're at about 412. So I looked at him and said, that's 130 ppm, so that's 130 feet of sea level rise that we've already baked into the system, right? And he just nodded yes.
So that means that low-lying countries, many coastal cities, if not all, will be underwater, which leads to gigantic humanitarian chaos, as you said. I mean, climate refugees in numbers that are unthinkable. We think we have refugee crises now, and in many places we do, but give us a magnitude of what this could look like.
Well, imagine every major coastal city on the planet being underwater. We're talking about tens, if not hundreds of millions of people. I think it's safe to say hundreds of millions of people. I mean, just off the top of my head, New York City, New Orleans, Miami, huge parts of LA, large parts of California, Mumbai, Dhaka, Jakarta, Ho Chi Minh City, Tokyo. You can go around the world and just keep naming them. All of those will be underwater. And so if we look at, for example, the refugee crisis from war-torn countries in the Middle East and North Africa, of what's happened in Europe and the millions of people trying to get into the EU and the crisis that's created politically, shifting so many governments to far-right extremes in response to this, you know, this upswing of right-wing fomented nationalism, xenophobia, racism, et cetera. And we're starting to see some of that play out here. A lot of these people trying to come into the U.S. from Mexico or coming up from Central America, the brunt of that is climate change driven, as well as U.S. policies down there in the past. And so we look at the number of refugees. We know it's already a crisis. This is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, things are really just starting as far as these impacts of once more of these cities, it becomes clear, they're going to have to be abandoned to the sea. And that's why the imperative is, if we had a sane government now, we would have an orderly evacuation, and they'd be finding ways to pay for it and understand this has to happen. You know, and I can give you an example closer to my hometown. I live in a small town called Port Townsend in the Pacific Northwest. It's in Washington State on the Olympic Peninsula. And recently, and this is a very progressive town politically, nevertheless, recently they invested several million dollars in an infrastructure project under their main street, which is at about 5 to 6 feet elevation above sea level, redoing sewer, electric lines, et cetera. Contrast that with, if you look out to the west coast of Washington State, you have the Makah tribe and the Quileute tribe, who for now more than 2 years, both of them have been actively moving their villages further uphill. Which one of those scenarios makes more sense?
Right, right. I think one of the things that's so bizarre to me is that the economic consequences of this, leaving aside the humanitarian and ecosystem and cultural and spiritual consequences, just the economic consequences of climate disruption are so catastrophic. I mean, I was just looking at there's just an article in Vice called The $1 Trillion Storm, How a Single Hurricane Could Rupture the World Economy, looking at Florida, you know, bankrupting insurance companies. You would think that the investment community would be extremely worried. But aside from insurance companies charging more for people to buy insurance in high-risk areas, they seem to be just doing denial. How do you understand this?
Well, yes and no. It's very interesting because what you said is accurate, but then also at the same time, corporate America is all too aware of it. I mean, when I was down in South Florida working on my book, I learned that there's already banks down in South Florida that will not give out 30-year mortgages. There's already insurance companies that they're raising their rates so high that people are literally not being able to afford to keep up with the insurance if they live in a flood zone. Literally, just in the last month, news came out that Bank of America Corporation is, and this was reported by Bloomberg, that they're worried very much so that flooded homeowners with mortgages with them are going to be defaulting on their mortgages. Walt Disney is worried about their theme parks getting too hot for vacationers. AT&T is afraid that hurricanes and wildfires are going to knock out its cell towers. Coca-Cola is worried about not having enough water to make Coke. So corporate America, it's a very interesting phenomenon, isn't it? Because on the one hand, there's, you know, they have their pawn in the White House and the people surrounding him doing their bidding. And yet at the same time, they are looking at the bottom line profits and being very real about, okay, here are the threats to our profits. And they're looking directly at these climate impacts.
Well, they're looking at it. They're worried about it. Are they doing anything?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that would be a worthy investigation and something to look at. But, you know, right now, obviously, they're not doing one of the most important things, in that they're, instead of throwing backing behind a candidate in the, you know, one of these Democratic candidates who's prioritizing climate change and policy and things that, you know, some radical changes that have to happen. Of course, they're still throwing all their, or the brunt of their monies behind the person who, instead of having a sane response, is stomping on the gas.
Meanwhile, this was another thing I didn't know, is that a lot of ecological and climate change activists around the world are being literally murdered every week.
That's right. And one of the areas where this is happening, if not the most dramatically, certainly in the very top portion of that, is in the Amazon. Brazilian environmental activists are being murdered at a very, very high rate and in very dramatic fashion there. And this is, of course, made all the worse now with Bolsonaro, who's been called the tropical Trump for good reason, is opening up the Amazon to logging and industrial agriculture. And literally, as we speak, I just saw a report from yesterday that that these companies are already bulldozing paths into parts of the Amazon. And of course, indigenous people living in there are losing their homes. I mean, they're losing the part of the world where they have lived for thousands of years. And so it's extremely worrisome development where, you know, people across the world who are dedicating their lives to protect these different areas are now under very grave threat by this increasing wave of right-wing governments that are hell-bent on going after these so-called resources.
Which, again, is such incredibly short-term thinking, because while some companies will turn an annual or, you know, 2 years or quarterly profit increase, in the long run, they're shooting themselves. It's hard to understand how they don't seem to care.
Well, it's insanity. And this is where, you know, when you have next quarter's financial goal or statement driving policy, I mean, you literally don't have humans making these decisions. Instead, you literally have pure greed that is in the driver's seat of policy, right? Because that is what is, all the decisions in corporate America are based upon how can we maximize profits. I mean, it's in the corporate charter, right? They are beholden to do everything in their power to maximize profits on an annual basis. And if that's what's driving the ship, then it's actually not surprising that this level of insanity is to the point now where we are looking at the very real possibility of annihilation of all complex life on Earth, including human beings, and yet people continue acting as though business as usual is okay. We can keep growing the economy, and we can keep treating the Earth as though it's this other that we can just keep extracting from, polluting and destroying, as though our very lives are not dependent on that planet. It is utter insanity, and it boggles my mind on a daily basis. And this is why in the book, when I tried to make sense of all of this and deal with it internally, how do I find meaning now living in the context of this, what is happening on the planet? We have to start with, what do I need to do to reconnect myself back in? Before we can even ask, okay, what am I going to do now in the midst of this crisis? We have to first start with hitting the pause button and just stopping and taking a deep breath and figuring out, where is it that I really connect in most deeply to the planet, and start there before we're going to start making the decision on what we need to do during this time.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, for all the amazing reporting in this book, and it is a very important and fact-filled book, as much as anything, it's also the story of grief and loss and bearing witness in the face of death. You're looking at devastation on a scale that most of us don't have the opportunity or will to really look at. And I mean, I felt, like I said, I had to take breaks from reading this and, go out with the dogs, kind of go for a walk and breathe deeply. But still, and even talking to you, I feel physically in my body that I'm being punched by this crisis. And the question of how you deal with that is something that you address in the book and something that we all have to really deal with.
Well, the way you describe what you had to do to take care of yourself, reading it with pausing, going outside, taking walks with the dog, that's how I wrote it. I mean, I was taking breaks every hour. I would sometimes feel like, what's the point? Why even continue? It's over. I would be completely distraught, demoralized, stricken with grief. And I would just walk outside. And I'm fortunate to live in a beautiful forest in a small solar-powered house. And I would just walk outside and just look at the trees and watch the Doug firs swaying in the wind and take a deep breath and just think, okay, you're still here. I'm still here. Okay, let's keep doing this. We can keep doing this. The book was a very complex experience for me because I got to go to some of the most magnificent, majestic, amazing places on the planet and really worship, really just open my heart and be blown away by the beauty and the magnitude of these places, but then also have my heart broken completely open watching what was happening to them, going back to Alaska, to an area where I used to cross a glacier to go do a climb, and that glacier is completely gone, just gone. And that felt like being punched in the gut, or it felt like just learning that a friend of mine had died. Going to the Great Barrier Reef, where I'd gone scuba diving before, almost 20 years before, and going over parts of the reef that were just bleach white, and just knowing most of that coral was going to die, if not all of it, and literally crying into my mask as I snorkeled over it. And that was the consistent experience. And I think that's why I was forced, the experience of writing the book forced me into this place of learning how to dance with my own grief. And that meant first making space to have it and having those feelings and finding ways to share that and talk about it with other people. And one of the best antidotes I found was just going out and being on the earth every single day and starting there. And realize and remembering, this is what I'm fighting for. This is what I'm writing this book for. This is my service to the planet. And that's why the subtitle is, finding meaning is a big part of this, because we are in this era of loss. We're in the sixth mass extinction. So where are we each going to find our own personal meaning and motivation to keep doing the right thing, to keep doing the moral thing? And the punchline of that for me, I think right now what has become my mantra is something that was taught to me by an indigenous elder, and I bring his voice in at the end of the book, and he pointed out to me, look, the Western colonial mindset is that we have rights. What are my rights? Well, indigenous thinking is that we're born with obligations. We're born with an obligation to take care of the planet and serve the planet. And we're born with an obligation to take care of future generations. And so when I shift that in my head, when I've shifted that and I wake up instead thinking, what do I need to do today to serve the planet? Then that really brings a whole new level of meaning to everything that I do. And I was very grateful to be able to share that with people in this book, because I think we're all struggling now, especially with the political crisis in this country of, what do we do? There's a million fires burning. Where do I put my energy? And I think we have to start with tapping back in deeply to the earth, listening, getting quiet and listening. And then I think the answers will come if we do that the right way. And then each one of us can find our own thing that we know that is coming from inside us of, this is how I'm going to serve the planet.
Well, and that really raises a question that you also address in the book, which is, is there hope? and you say that you are neither hopeful nor hopeless, because those two things are two sides of the same coin. What's the alternative?
Well, I am very critical of hope, and I had to kind of dive into that again, the book, the crisis, the existential threat that it poses to all of us. It really forced the issue in. And so I had to look at it, and I learned, you know, really thinking about it more deeply, that hope is this future-based philosophy. We lose our agency when we hope. I feel like I give it away to a future time or to some other person or to some famous activist to tell me what to do, or a politician, instead of maintaining that agency within myself. What can I do right now? And I quote Czech dissident writer and statesman Václav Havel in the book, his famous quote, where he says, "Hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something is worth doing, no matter how it turns out." Because that really resonated with me, because I had reached a point at the end of the book where, when you look at everything that I've written about, and this is not a comprehensive book, I didn't go to Greenland, I didn't go to Antarctica. And that, when I look at the totality and where everything is and where it's heading, it's extremely grim. And so I have to let go of the results of my actions. And I have to find that moral obligation of, why am I doing things? And I'm going to do it anyway, because it's the right thing to do, kind of danger be damned, kind of results be damned. I'm going to do this because it's the right thing to do. It looks like we may well be on the way out as a species. Nobody can say that for sure. But regardless, are we not morally obliged to still do the right thing? Am I not morally obliged to still wake up every day and try to figure out, how can I be most effective? Where can I do the most good? And then get busy doing that work. I owe that to the planet, and I owe that to future generations.
What do you say to young people when they say, you know, when they ask you, as I'm sure they do, what can I do?
I've actually started, not by design, but I've started working with young people and talking to classes and being more active there. And I'm actually hosting a young man out where I live, who decided he didn't make sense for him to be in college. He literally pulled out of college and said, "Look, I know what's happening. I see what's coming. It doesn't make sense for me to get a job and try to be part of this economy. I want to be on the land, and I want to learn skills around that." And so he's out living with me and doing exactly that, taking a job with the Washington Conservation Corps. And he's the second person like that that I've had out on the land where I live. And so we talk about this all the time. And what I hear from him, and it's what I hear from some of the other classes that I've spoken with, is that the younger generations get it. And it's interesting, because they're, you know, my generation, you know, I'm 50 years old, like, we're heavily involved with grieving for what we've lost and what we're losing. Well, the younger generations, and like my friend who's 22 years old, for example, he's not grieving so much as he's pissed off. He's angry, because they never had a chance. You know, this stuff was gone before they had a chance to even experience a lot of this. And he's asking these same questions. Well, what do we do, and what do I do? And I tell him the same thing I just told you, which is, you know, first you need to really tap in and listen and feel like where your heart is being pulled and what you feel passionate about, what you might do. One of the people I spoke with, he's getting more involved in the Extinction Rebellion, which is spreading internationally now, a very effective group at starting to shut down parts of cities to send the message to governments that we're not going to keep going along with business as usual. We are going to force the issue, and you're going to pay attention, and you're going to start handling this crisis in a more responsible way and doing the right thing. And others are being pulled to maybe just, they're going to go be a farmer, or they're going to go learn how to work with their hands and things like that. So we are, I think, in the midst of this huge awakening in younger generations, with Greta Thunberg, the young Scandinavian woman who started, really is the impetus of a lot of these school strikes and student protests, by refusing to go to school, because she says, "Why go to school if I don't have a future?" And that's spreading around now. We're coming up on March 15th, literally 2 days after I speak in Santa Fe. Students from schools in at least 50 countries are going to literally be going on strike and walking out of class. So we're seeing a huge movement that's kicking off, and I can only see that growing at this point.
Darjamail is author of the book The End of Ice: Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. And ladies and gentlemen, yeah, it's depressing, but it's also a beautifully written book and worth reading and so full of love. And I think that that love that you have for land and people and nature itself and that understanding of yourself and all of us as part of nature instead of apart from it is, it's just important to kind of hold that, and therefore highly recommended book.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. I really appreciate that. It was really great to talk with you.
And once again, Darjamail will be speaking at the Lenzik Center for Performing Arts on Wednesday, March 13th, brought to us thanks to the Lannan Foundation. For more information, lannan.org. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential. Offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.